Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Okay, so I hope you have the handout, and just to briefly walk through the structure here, I'm going to start with an introduction on how Aquinas approaches the moral life. Then I'm going to look at moral relativism and where is their agreement, where is their disagreement. Then I'm going to look at three different ways in which someone we know might have genuine goods that they're pursuing, that we admire, and that allows us to be friends with them. In this order, the good, the beautiful, and the true. Show how each of those require, when lived faithfully, to wrestle with the question of ultimate meaning of God. And then some exhortations and some principles for the moral life in college. So I think starting introduction here, all people knowingly or unknowingly seek the good, that the moral life as Aquinas conceives it is very attractive to someone who is not Christian, who's not rooted in this foundation, because probably that person conceives of the moral life in a Christian understanding as being just following rules, as a sort of God has given a lot of rules, mostly don'ts, and that Christian life is some form of just looking up the rule, kind of like plug and chug in a mathematics sense, and just following the rule. And the Christian understanding, of course, is that law is ordered to love. So this quote from St. Augustine I want to start with here, "Our heart is restless until it rests in you," is a great way of focusing what moral life means. We should pause on the "our heart" part of this. Notice that on the one hand, it's a plural, what we have. On the other hand, it's in the singular. Our heart is restless. So what is St. Augustine getting at here? That on the one hand, we all have things that are unique to us in terms of what we love, things we think are lovable. So I'm coming from St. Vincent College. It's a Benedictine college. I love Benedictine spirituality. I love my adopted hometown of La Trobe. And here I would presume that, perhaps, that you love your universities, but that you love something that is unique to where you grew up or to the kind of community that you've embraced. But that going up from there, we would find that there are things that we love in common. For example, friendship. While my friends and your friends may be different, we recognize or we agree that friendship is central to a moral life. And going up from there, that love itself is something that attracts us. And that, of course, the Christian says God is love. To say that love is the North Star of life is to say that we do agree. And I think that those friends, those people who are caught up in that relativistic ambient culture, in a civil situation where they don't feel cornered, would say, yes, I agree that we all seek love. Aquinas, in a more scientific and philosophical way, quote 1b, puts it this way. "I answer that it is impossible for any created good to constitute man's happiness. For happiness is the perfect good which lulls the appetite altogether. Else it would not be the last end, if something yet remained to be desired. Now the object of the will, i.e. of man's appetite, is the universal good, just as the object of the intellect is the universal true. Hence it is evident that naught can lull man's will save the universal good. This is to be found not in any creature, but in God alone, because every creature has goodness by participation. Wherefore, God alone can satisfy the will of man according to the words of the psalmist, who satisfieth thy desire with good things. Therefore, God alone constitutes man's happiness. So seeking rest of our desires, directing them to objects in which our appetite is lulled, is the goal of moral life. And in order to achieve that, then, one of the sayings in Benedictine spirituality that comes from the life of Saint Benedict is that those who love more can do more. We need then to form our characters so that we're more capable of achieving, seeking out, recognizing true love, and resting in it. In our natural orientation, in our natural faculties, that means directing our passions, our aversions, our hopes, and our fears so that we are moderate, so that we are courageous. It means directing our will so that I will not just my own good, which is important, but that I will the good of others and ultimately the good of all human beings. We call that justice. We need to direct our reasoning ability so that we can determine the means to bring about that end that we seek, and this is prudence. We also need to, so thinking back to Sister Anna's talk on intellectual life, we also need to anticipate in moral life that there are going to be very difficult moral situations. We think of things like sexual morality, end-of-life issues, bioethical issues. We need to learn how to reason well in that speculative sense, and to come to know the principles that should guide our living in accordance with reality, and that's wisdom. But as these passages point us to, that's not enough. That humans, we could say, are finite creatures, right? We're mortal, but we tend toward the infinite. And so we recognize that pursuit of the good, of the true, of the beautiful, points us to something beyond our faculties. And the Christian response, of course, is that nature is perfected, is built upon by grace, that we need to receive something that God gives to us. We call these infused virtues, the chief of which are the theological, faith, hope, and charity, that allow us to rest in that object that all humans are seeking, the God who is love. And I think that is attractive. I think that someone, whatever their positions may be, while they're going to say, I maybe get hung up on the word God, that might be the issue, that it's not so much a rejection of a universal good or of an aim, but it may be something about the word God that has baggage for that person. That this is something that I think can be a common basis of conversation. And so moving to the second section, I want to talk about subjectivity and objectivity in morality, what the Thomists and the relativists agree upon, and where they diverge. So starting with the subjective aspect. We could say moral relativism, there's maybe a weaker and a stronger form, is that all moral claims and actions are, if they're good or bad, it's simply for that person in that situation, or for that culture, or for that historical period. But that nothing is good or bad in the kind of totality, in that objective sense of the whole. Or the stronger version, there really is no such thing as good and bad. That's just preference language. I prefer this thing, you prefer that thing. Can a Thomist agree to that? Not that stronger one. And that's a harder challenge. But are there things in moral life that are subjective? Let's take getting ready for lunch as an example of this. While we may all agree that being moderate at the table is an important thing, what does it mean to eat moderately at lunch today, right here and right now? If I were a lineman on the football team, a moderate lunch would look a little different than what a moderate lunch would look for me. If I ate the moderate lunch of the football player, the lineman, things wouldn't go so well in the afternoon for me. And vice versa, right? You can imagine for him eating I don't think it'll be that dainty, I'm pretty hungry, but that it will be dainty for him. So there's a subjective aspect of the moderate meal. There are additional factors, of course, things like health considerations. If I have celiac disease, if I am preparing for a medical procedure that requires fasting, if it is a Friday in Lent, that there are these subjective aspects of a moral situation that require analysis and deliberation, and that those change in various circumstances. But where we disagree, of course, is that there are also objective factors, and that those are the fundamental ones, the natural law, and even the human and the divine law that guides us in understanding how to do what is the right thing. I don't think, though, that that relativist with whom we're trying to have a conversation with really rejects that. I think sometimes that's just a debater's position. It's a good way to end an argument. So if we found something like, for example, killing the innocent intentionally, racism, we'd probably find that person would say, yes, I agree that that is always and everywhere wrong. Okay, that there may be people who think that's okay, and those people are always and everywhere wrong. I think that's more often what we're dealing with. And it's hard to get that situation where we can understand where we see eye to eye, but that any moral life that's lived seeking the good of another requires starting where we agree. Where do we agree? That can become a foundation for where those hard cases where we disagree. Okay, so quote 2A. I just want to point your attention, because of where we are, thinking again of those subjective things, that Adam Tate, who teaches at Clayton State University in the great state of Georgia, has written a book, 2018, Catholics Lost Cause, South Carolina Catholics in the American South, 1820 to 1861. It used to be that the Diocese of Charleston included the Carolinas and Georgia, so it's almost like a kind of historic aspect of coming together these three states in the Catholic world. I'm going to read that passage from Adam Tate, and I want you to see that we have to recognize that compromise, agreement, seeing eye to eye is important, but there can be a mistake of going too far. Leading up to the Civil War, South Carolina Catholics sought to draw a clear line between themselves and their Protestant neighbors, while at the same time showing themselves to be trustworthy, virtuous, and loyal citizens. Despite noteworthy successes, the efforts to maintain a distinctive position on the slavery issue, to portray themselves as both faithful Catholics and loyal Southerners, failed. And they eventually capitulated to the position of the dominant culture in which they lived. So we have to be careful then that there are some issues that are just objectively wrong and about which we disagree. I think you can think of things like abortion comes to mind, gender identity issues, sexual morality, that there just is a fundamental disagreement there and that there can't be compromise on things like killing the innocent. So we don't want to start with those. So let's read some Aquinas to try to get a little more clarity on these important distinctions that he wants to make. 2b. I answer that, as stated above, every action takes its species from its object, while human action, which is called moral, takes its species from the object in relation to the principle of human actions, which is the reason. Wherefore, if the object of an action includes something in accord with the order of reason, it will be a good action according to its species. For instance, to give alms to a person in want. On the other hand, if it includes something repugnant to the order of reason, it will be an evil according to its species. For instance, to steal, which is to appropriate what belongs to another. But it may happen that the object of an action does not include something pertaining to the order of reason. For instance, to pick up a straw from the ground, to walk in the field, and the like. And such actions are indifferent according to their species. So we are engaged in intellectual activity. Attending a lecture in the abstract is neither morally good nor morally evil. We just heard about how one could attend a lecture and engage in zoning out and not paying attention, or one could engage in the lecture and direct it toward some morally good action. So in the abstract, there's a wide range of human actions that are neither morally good nor morally bad. And I think the relativist often has in mind a focus on that sort of thing. But look at quote 2C. When it comes to the concrete circumstances of life, that's no longer true. Every individual action must needs have some circumstance that makes it good or bad, at least in respect of the intention of the end. For since it belongs to the reason to direct, if an action that proceeds from deliberate reason be not directed to the due end, it is by that fact alone repugnant to reason and has the character of evil. But if it be directed to a due end, it is in accord with reason, wherefore it has the character of good. Now it must needs be either directed or not directed to a due end. Consequently, every human action that proceeds from deliberate reason, if it be considered in the individual, must be good or bad. He goes on to say that there are some actions that aren't because of deliberate reason. For example, blinking. You may notice I move a little bit and I talk with my hands. To some extent, that's just a nervous tick. I remember my friend in college. You knew Kenny was doing metaphysics because he was doing this. This was what he went to. He wanted to think about metaphysical thoughts. Those aren't subject to deliberation. But in general, every human action, to make it a human action, is to be the result of deliberation. So think about getting up this morning. You chose beforehand, most likely, that you were going to be here today. And when you woke up in the morning, you may have just kind of gone into autopilot. You know, you get dressed, you get some breakfast, you kind of move through the day. But you realize that that was the result of a deliberate choice you made the day before. And perhaps at some point this morning, or maybe immediately you woke up in the morning and you said, maybe I could sleep a little bit longer, right? Maybe that you immediately deliberated when you woke up. So we recognize that we can always deliberate, and it's important that as much as possible we subject our actions to deliberation. Probably not blinking. That would probably not go so well if we deliberate about when to blink and when not to blink in general. So in the concrete, while it may be true that actions can be morally indifferent abstractly, I always have to ask myself, is attending this lecture or giving this lecture morally good? Am I directing it to a due end? Given all of my obligations I have in life, is it appropriate that I'm here doing this right now? And so even those things that are subjective must be directed to that objective good. So hopefully that friend of ours would recognize that, yeah, when you go through your day, we always have to ask ourselves, is this what I should be doing? It's advising season at St. Vincent right now, where we're looking at spring semester. What should I be doing this week? Thinking bigger, right? Is my major appropriate to my calling? Am I being a good student? Is attending college in the spring the central or good for me? Am I directing those rightly? We do need to do that. What I want to do now is help us to focus on three ways in which these friends of ours or potential friends of ours can be helped to see that a life, if it's going to be good in any way, even in that subjective way of saying I'm doing what I think is the right for me, needs to ultimately wrestle with the question of God and of meaning and purpose. If you've read Zena Hintz's Lost in Thought, to some extent I'm thinking about the way she lays this out. The possibility of a kind of morally good life, of doing good deeds, the possibility of a kind of artistic life, of a life cultivating beauty, and then the intellectual life. Okay, so I want to start with this natural life of moral action seeking the good. Those friends of ours who do good things, they might right now be serving in a soup kitchen, helping people in a hospital, that we admire that they really are doing good things. And I don't want to detract from that. I don't want to say that's not true, even if we need to qualify it. But we can't rest with that. And the way that I'm going to put it, something that's really surprised me as a professor, the number of times I've taught Aristotle, Augustine, or Aquinas, and we explain what happiness is, and I ask the students, do you think someone can be happy without God, without directing their life to God, or without knowing that there's a God? What I've found over the years is the students who want to defend that, yes, you can, tend to be Christians. It's a weird thing. You know, why is it the Christian students in my class who are saying this? I think there's at least two reasons. One is that, again, they recognize that friend of mine might be the roommate, might be a childhood friend who's not a believer, does really good things, and seems very content. Okay, so that may be true. I think the second thing is not wanting to judge somebody, right? Not wanting to be in the position of a judge, and especially when we're talking about heaven and hell. right? I don't want to say of my roommate where the ultimate end is for that person. I think there's something laudable about that, that we should try to avoid forming those kinds of judgments. But we have to also recognize an obligation to help that person see that that doing good deeds, life like that, has to wrestle with some questions. I'm going to give three questions. First, what makes it good? What's the cause of those actions being good? If we were to ask that person, okay, so you got up on Saturday morning and you decided to go to the soup kitchen and help. Another person got up on Saturday morning and started the drinking very early in preparation for the football game. Is one of those good and one of those not so good, or how would we analyze that? I think that what we see in modern philosophy and modern ethics is that the project, thinking of Kant or Mill, of trying to derive objective moral guidance for life without God failed. That Nietzsche and Sartre were right. That if there is no God, everything is permitted. And that the postmodern condition, the condition of relativism that we face right now, is a result of trying to derive moral do's and don'ts without God in the picture. If there is no foundation for life, we can't really say that that's good. It's just one preference and another. Getting up early to start the partying, getting up early to help the poor. Those are just different preferences. And I don't think anyone really thinks that. Maybe in a debate they do, right? But in real life. The second question is, what is the motive of doing those good deeds? What's the end that you have in mind in doing those? Let's take something like Valentine's Day. That if I were to get my wife flowers on Valentine's Day, and she says, thank you so much. And I say, I'm just doing my duty. Do you think she's pleased with this? Do you think she wants those? I think she looks at them, says, ugh, every time she walks by them. I think it would be doing a favor to throw them out because they remind her that I didn't do my duty, right? That to give someone flowers on Valentine's Day is to need a motive of love. Right, is to require a selfless, sacrificial kind of giving. And so for that person who says, I don't have that motive, you'd say, don't you recognize that when you're doing those good things for those poor people, if your motive isn't a pure one, if it's for your resume, if it's because you love the way you feel when your friends say how good you are, that it's not morally good. We have to wrestle with the end. The third question then, which follows from that, are there good actions that we need to do that require knowledge of what God wants for us? Are there things that it would require saying yes to God to know that they're good? Let's go back to the football game. Can we say of a football player that he's a good player if he doesn't know what team he's on, what position he plays, what the playbook is, who the coach is? Of course not. We can, in the abstract, again, recognize that, boy, I'd love to have someone on my team, and we just need to direct him. If he's not directing his will, directing his greatness, his action toward the mind of the coach, the plan, he's not good. And he's not good for the team. And we all know that kind of player that we, you know, have trouble with when we're rooting for our teams, is that if there's a God who wants a certain relationship with us, and we're saying no to it, or claiming to be indifferent, it's like saying that I can be a good son to my parents without knowing what they want of me. Should I come home for Thanksgiving? Should I give them a gift for this? I need to know these particular things to know how to love. And so let's read some Aquinas. We'll just read a little of this, 3a. I answer that man must of necessity desire all whatsoever he desires for the last end. This is evident for two reasons. First, because whatever man desires, he desires it under the aspect of good. And if he desires it not as his perfect good, which is the last end, he must of necessity desire it as tending to the perfect good. Because the beginning of anything is always ordained to its completion, as is clearly the case in effects both of nature and of art. Wherefore, every beginning of perfection is ordained to complete perfection, which is achieved through the last end. And I'm going to stop there in this section, that we can't stop when we aren't at a resting point in moral life. The second way of life, friends we may have, and maybe we could have combinations of these, is someone we recognize who's a friend or we find attraction to because they cultivate beauty, either in their attire, in the way they decorate their room, in their architectural interests, in their love of art, in their love of going for a hike that involves taking in the beauty of nature. And that person might say to us that we don't respond to poems with arguments, right? We don't respond to art with arguments, we respond to it with appreciation. Yeah, I can't argue for what I call beautiful, but I can rest in it and admire, and that's enough. I don't need to look to the question of ultimacy. I think we'd find the same thing here, that can't stand on its own. So 4A, what does it mean to be beautiful? The beautiful is the same as the good, and they differ in aspect only. For since good is what all seek, the notion of good is that which calms the desire, while the notion of the beautiful is that which calms the desire by being seen or known. So on the one hand, we seek beauty in a visual sense. Think of colors, of sunsets, that we rest in them. There's a kind of resting in that. On the other hand, there's something that's beautiful. We think of the expression, easy on the eyes, right? That's a great expression, I think. You know, when we say someone's handsome or beautiful, we use the expression, are my eyes just relax? Intellectual beauty, that by grasping it, we think of something like solving a puzzle, like Sudoku, or watching a movie and saying, I know who did it. Or the mathematician who just gets great delight in the proof itself and just seeing that because of that very small assumption I made, all of it necessarily followed at the end. And there's something beautiful about that. You can imagine the engineering mind or the mathematical or scientific mind pursues that kind of intellectual beauty. What we would ask that person is, it's well and good and important to say there's a beauty in Japanese culture. There's a beauty in Irish culture. There's a beauty in even some forms of modern American culture. But to say that they're all beautiful requires asking the question, what causes them to be beautiful? What do they have in common that you can say, hey, I don't cultivate myself that aesthetic that person does, but I really appreciate that. You know, I really see the beauty. What are you talking about if not there being something that itself is beautiful? And while I don't want to get into, because this is not on intellectual life, on the forms and the disagreement between Plato and Aristotle and so forth, that I think Plato's Symposium and Socrates' speech is really helpful. That our growth in appreciation of beauty usually starts with one beautiful body, one beautiful person, and it moves to the soul or to beautiful people. And then from there, it keeps going upward, that we recognize, wow, it's everything that exists has a beauty that relates it to everything else. And that pursuit of a beautiful, artistic, poetic, performative life needs to push itself to ask what that is. Okay, the third and final one, the natural intellectual life that seeks the true. And I'll just be somewhat self-referential here, that I think when I was in high school and college, I don't think I was a moral relativist, and I look back on that, I don't think I necessarily thought that. I was a chemistry major because I thought, this is getting at the fundamental aspect of reality. That's what I thought. You know, everything is made out of what they're studying in chemistry. And the further I go in this, the closer I'm getting to the foundation. Right? That's what intellectual life is about. And that's what led me to philosophy and led me to the church. So this person, though, is a little different that we're talking about. This is that person who, on the one hand, we share in conversations and they love quantum mechanics and they love talking about, you know, Japanese culture and history, and they just have this mind that is filled either with curiosity or wonder, and we want to distinguish between those two, that maybe there's a genuine wonder driving it there, but they just don't think we need to ground that in the ultimate meaning question. They just think we can just pursue our life of just pursuing these sorts of truths without saying, are they my truth or are they the truth and is there an ultimate truth? I think where you would go with that is St. John Henry Newman's The Idea of University, which for me was one of the central texts of getting me from chemistry to philosophy and philosophy to faith, is that what Newman does is he goes as far as he can and say, a liberal arts college has as its goal forming habits of mind, a philosophical habit. Do we want those students to be moral? Of course we do. Do we want them to be Catholic? Of course we do. But we need to be careful in saying there is a real good of a liberal arts formation that may even in some ways be difficult to integrate into moral and spiritual life, right? That may make it even harder to integrate. And if you have that sense in you, I think you know what I mean, that it's hard to be someone who gets lost in thought and then have to realize, okay, how do I bring that into like my moral life and my spiritual life? That's very challenging. But here's what Newman says that I think we want to say to that person. That modesty, that claim that I'm being modest and saying I just don't know, maybe I'm an agnostic as opposed to an atheist, hiding behind that is a kind of pride. So let's read Newman and let's try to explain. This embellishment of the exterior in the mere philosopher is almost the beginning and the end of philosophical morality. This is why it aims at being modest rather than humble. This is how it can be proud at the very time that it is unassuming. To humility, indeed, it does not even aspire. Humility is one of the most difficult of virtues both to attain and to ascertain. I think what we find in the public square, especially in a university, is this claim that it's those Christians, those objectivists, who are the narrow-minded ones, right? They're not broad-minded because they think something is true. And the Christian response is to say that you know that there is nothing to be known is self-contradictory. To say I'm being modest in saying we can't have knowledge, or to claim that you have knowledge of the whole is prideful, is itself a dogmatic statement that needs analysis. And the Christian response is that humility consists in conforming ourselves to the truth, of submitting to the truth, rather than what I think is often connected with this intellectual life, a kind of delight in creating an identity, of deciding for myself what the life is, rather than the difficult task of humbling myself before the awesomeness of reality. Going to our final section, and just one more point, thinking in an Aristotelian way, that if you're trying to pursue knowledge of the facts, the reasoned fact, behind all these phenomena we experience, unless there is an ultimate reason, you know, a truth behind all those facts, the whole edifice of science falls apart. Anyone who studied mathematics eventually comes to this. Well, how do we know those principles we started with, that A equals A? If A equals B, then B equals A. How do we know those are true? We have to keep pushing to a foundation, or else we just end up in the relativism problem that we face. Okay, section 6, the moral life of nature, perfected by grace, rests in the true, the good, and the beautiful. I'm not going to work through the arguments here, but what Aquinas shows, I really encourage you to look at the Prima Secundae, the treatise on happiness, is that he works systematically through all the sorts of things that someone could say would make us happy, that would be the goal of moral life, and shows that neither wealth, or honor, fame, or glory, power, any good of the body, pleasure, any good of the soul, or even any created good, the universe attended to as a whole, that none of that can make us happy, and that that inquiry for the good directs us toward the question of faith. Again, which is something that everyone has to wrestle with individually, though with the help of a community that supports that. So I want to end with some more concrete points about moral life, and again, moral life in college, kind of setting aside that dialogue partner of us that we have, that person we're trying to help open up to these bigger questions. So three things. First, moral life for you right now is to be the best student you can be. That is your calling for now, the 4 years that you're here, and perhaps in the future, if you continue to study. And this requires things like not consulting ChatGPT. It requires things like going to your classes and doing the reading and being prepared for it. There's lots of good things we could all be doing all the time, and if we find ourselves saying that those good things I want to do mean that I'm not doing my homework for class, I either have to change my major so that those things that I'm interested in are the things that I'm focused on, or I need to change my habits. The good of a university is intellectual life. that needs support and roots in moral and spiritual life, but we can't think that I'm doing a good job as a college student if I'm shirking that obligation to be a good student. It also requires thinking about that as well, of saying, asking the question, is my ultimate calling to the examined life? As I tell my students, if you like these books too much, you might get stuck here forever, like that happens to some of us, right? They never let you leave, so you got to be careful. How much do you love these books, and how much are you committed to them? It also means C.S. Lewis, Learning in Wartime, is an excellent reflection on this. He says that we need to be cautious that if we begin to enjoy more the fact that we know it than the thing that we know, we've got a problem on our hands. He uses the image of cutting out, poking out the eye, right? That I need to realize that if I'm beginning to be excited about the fact that everyone has to listen to my lecture, I should say has probably, right, not gets to, then I've lost the focus on it's the thing known that's greater than me that unites me to it in love by elevating it rather than me bringing it down to me as my possession. A second principle then is to remember that your vocation is not in the future, it is now. We could maybe speak more in terms of states of life. That is uncertain for some of you, or maybe for all of you, whether you call it to priestly, religious, or lay life, but that your primary vocation, the universal call to holiness, St. Thérèse of Lisieux speaks about the call to charity, to love. That's not in the future, right? That's right now. And the more you form yourself in that vocation to love, to seek rest, the more you'll be able to discern that future in a clear fashion. And also, the less you'll worry about it, right? Because you have this rest. Third and finally, and the symposium comes to mind, that the sacraments need to be at the center. And I do think there's a challenge sometimes in intellectual life, and we have to ask ourselves this. Do I find that going to the sacraments, going to Mass or going to the prayer, is something that I really love the intellectual life, and then I go and do that because I know you need to at least go on Sundays? We recognize we've disordered things if we find that, and I think that's very common. I certainly myself, when I converted, really thought of reading Aristotle and Aquinas as the focus of life, and then realized I also need have this desire to go to worship. And I realized that that's not the proper ordering. We need to direct that to worship. So I'd close with really, you know, reminding us of that principle that is central, at least in Benedict and spirituality, and I think is compatible with how Augustine or how Aquinas would put it, that the more we love, the more we'll be able to do. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.